Good morning, everyone. It's such a blessing to be back at our second home. So I was born and raised in Elmira, Ontario, and WMB has been my, shout out to Elmira, WMB has been my home church since I was born. But 16 years ago, as Renee mentioned, I moved to the Philippines. I'm a full-time missionary there. That's where I met my wife, Jam. And I'm so grateful to be able to serve full-time as the director of Tender, a Christian nonprofit organization where we are helping children from the most extreme poverty in Manila to go to school, to get an education, to be discipled, and to have a better future. And so I'm so excited to share with you this morning the message that I believe God's put on my heart with the title, When Hardship Ignites Purpose. And I want to ask you, have you ever walked through a hardship that unexpectedly gave you a new sense of purpose? Maybe there's a difficult season in your life that stirred in you a desire to make a change, either in your own life or in someone else's. Sometimes it's the struggles we never would have chosen that ignite that passion. Maybe a mental health battle, witnessing abuse, the deep pain of loss, losing someone too soon, maybe to suicide, illness, or other tragedies. How do we respond when hardships happen? Because it's inevitable, right? In life, hardships are going to happen. We can either react to them or we can respond to them. When we react, that's when we act only out of emotion. We don't give ourselves the time to process the situation, and we feel powerless in the situation. We can react with anger, bitterness, despair, and that's a very natural or normal instinct to an overwhelming hardship. That's often our automatic response, is to react with emotion. But when we respond, as opposed to just reacting, we're not only acting out of emotion, but we're also taking measured, thoughtful, or even prayerful steps to face or even overcome a struggle. And I want to look today at the way that Paul in the New Testament responds to hardships. Specifically, we're going to do a deep dive into Acts chapter 16, the second half of chapter 16. And here in Acts chapter 16, this is Paul's second missionary journey. You see that red line on the map. He's now revisiting established churches in Europe. This is just after the Jerusalem Council, which was a meeting of early Christian leaders, had determined that Gentiles, people who aren't Jewish, do not need to follow Jewish law to be saved. Okay, so Paul and his trusted companion Silas have set out to strengthen existing churches, to deliver these decrees of the Jerusalem Council, and also to expand the gospel into new regions in Europe. So in Acts chapter 16, verse 16, Paul and Silas find themselves in the Roman colony of Philippi, a prominent city in Macedonia. And we're going to dive right in, starting with verse 16. So it says here, once we were going to the place of prayer, we were met by a female slave who had a spirit by which she predicted the future. She earned a great deal of money for her owners by fortune telling. She followed Paul and the rest of us, shouting, "These men are servants of the Most High God who are telling you the way to be saved." She kept this up for many days. Finally, Paul became so annoyed that he turned around and said to the spirit, "In the name of Jesus Christ, I command you to come out of her." At that moment, the spirit left her. When her owners realized that their hope of making money was gone, they seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace to face the authorities. They brought them before the magistrates and said, "These men are Jews and are throwing our city into an uproar by advocating customs unlawful for us Romans to accept or practice." Now, who are the magistrates? I'll pause for a second. The magistrates are the two highest ranking Roman civil officials. They govern the Roman colony of Philippi, and they act as both judges and law enforcement. They're like the judge and the police, wielding the authority to punish Paul and Silas without a trial. Okay? And now, what's the issue with Paul casting a spirit out of this slave girl? Well, her owners were profiting off that ability, right? And this demonic spirit gave her supernatural insight into other people's lives. This wasn't trickery or manipulation or sleight of hand. This was a real spiritual power within her, allowing her to reveal things that others could not know. And when the girl shouts, "These men are servants of the Most High God, telling you the way to be saved," she's giving a supernatural testimony to their divine credentials and their message. You might think Paul would appreciate this, right? The first time I read it, I thought, what she's saying is great. Wouldn't Paul and Silas want her to preach that on a pulpit, that these men are from God and they're telling you the way to be saved? The message is good. But remember, this girl has been taken captive, not only as a slave, she has human captors, but she's been taken captive by some sort of dark spirit. And she's constantly following Paul and his companions for days and days on end, shouting this. It's almost like, although it's good news, it's like she's berating them with it over and over and over for days until Paul gets annoyed, honestly. Now, if you recall, Jesus also told demons within possessed people to be silent, even when they told the truth about Christ. So the problem isn't the message, it's the source of the message. Notice also how when the owners of the slave point out, "These men are Jews," why do they point that out? "These men are Jews and are throwing our city into an uproar." Well, anti-Jewish sentiment lay very close to the surface in pagan antiquity. So the Jewish community in Philippi was very, very small. They were the minority living in a very pagan, Roman-influenced city. So there's not a lot of respect for Judaism. They wouldn't understand it. They wouldn't understand their God, their customs, their beliefs. They would have discriminated against it. There would have been a lot of anti-Semitism. There wasn't even a single synagogue in Philippi. So they're the minority. And let's continue reading on. It says, if I get this clicker to work, maybe I got to be closer. Okay, I jumped ahead. There we go. I must still be a little jet lagged. Here we go. The crowd joined in the attack against Paul and Silas. The crowd joined in. And the magistrates ordered them to be stripped and beaten with rods. After they had been severely flogged, they were thrown into prison and the jailer was commanded to guard them carefully. When he received these orders, he put them in the inner cell and fastened their feet in the stocks. They were beaten in public because of casting a spirit out of a slave girl. Now, Jewish legal tradition gave a maximum number of blows that could be delivered when beating an offender. The number of lashes may not exceed 40. That's in the Torah, that's in Deuteronomy in the Old Testament. But in Rome, the Romans, where we are now, the Romans had no such limit. We simply know that Paul and Silas were beaten severely. And you may be familiar with the passage later Paul writes in 2 Corinthians about all these experiences, being beaten, being imprisoned, being shipwrecked, being starved, right? This is what he's talking about. This is one of those times where him and Silas were beaten and imprisoned. Also, it's worth noting that in the Roman Empire, there were two very different laws, okay? There was one law for citizens of Rome, and there was another entirely different law for those who were not citizens. Roman citizens had specific, zealously guarded civil rights, whereas non-citizens had no civil rights and were subject to the whims of both the multitude and those magistrates. We'll see later in the text that the magistrates were unaware that Paul and Silas were actually Roman citizens. So they're Jewish, but they're also Roman citizens. They didn't learn this until after they had already beaten and imprisoned Paul and Silas. Maybe they didn't care to ask, or they weren't listening if Paul and Silas tried to speak up. They weren't aware that they were Roman citizens. They were treated like non-citizens. Now, what do Paul and Silas do after being beaten and then shackled and locked in prison? I don't know about you, but I probably would have wallowed in the pain, the anger. I would have been pretty angry, maybe outraged in this unjust treatment. I probably would have completely missed an opportunity that God was about to reveal. But this horrendous hardship actually spurs Paul and Silas even more to fulfill their passion and their purpose to spread the gospel. Let's continue on. It says, about midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God. And the other prisoners were listening to them. Suddenly, there was such a violent earthquake that the foundations of the prison were shaken. At once, all the prison doors flew open and everyone's chains came loose. The jailer woke up, and when he saw the prison doors open, he drew his sword and was about to kill himself because he thought the prisoners had escaped. But Paul shouted, "Don't harm yourself. We are all here." I love the way that God uses a natural phenomenon, the earthquake, to carry out this miracle. And it is a miracle. I strongly believe it's a miracle, not only because of the earthquake's perfect timing and location, very convenient for Paul and Silas, but the way the doors are all opened, the way the chains that would have been locked to their wrists and ankles all came loose. I've never heard of an earthquake that can do that. But you know, there's always going to be doubters, isn't there? Some people might hear the story and say, it was an earthquake, right? Some people wish, God, why wouldn't you just make the chains magically fall off? Why do you need an earthquake? But this is the way the word Lord works sometimes. He uses natural phenomena. There's going to be doubters, but to me, it's very clear that this was a miracle. And for me, it would have been very easy for Paul and Silas to escape in that moment, thinking God provided a miraculous jailbreak. It's almost like this is another test, though. And instead of a test through hardship, now God is giving an easy exit. And yet Paul and Silas, to them, the lives of others are still more important than their own personal freedom and comfort. So even though God miraculously provides this exit, it seems like another test. And instead of escaping, Paul and Silas stay to protect the life of a stranger, the jailer. Have you ever had that in your life where there seems to be an easy exit, an easy way out, but maybe it's not the right option? So let's continue on. The jailer called for lights. He rushed in and he fell trembling before Paul and Silas, trembling. He brought them out and asked, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" They replied, "Believe in the Lord Jesus and you will be saved, you and your household." Then they spoke the word of the Lord to him and all the others in his house. At that hour of the night, the jailer took them and washed their wounds. Then immediately he and all his household were baptized. They didn't even wait. The jailer brought them into his house and set a meal before them. He was filled with joy because he had come to believe in God, he and his whole household. When it was daylight, the magistrates sent their officials to the jailer with the order, "Release those men." The jailer told Paul, "The magistrates have ordered that you and Silas be released. Now you can leave. Go in peace." But Paul said to the officers, "They beat us publicly without a trial, even though we are Roman citizens, and they threw us into prison. Now do they want to get rid of us quietly? No. Let them come themselves and escort us out." Take note that Paul's response to the mistreatment was not just to praise and worship God. It's beautiful that that was his first instinct, to praise, to worship, to pray. But that's not all that they did. Paul also still calls out the abusers. He doesn't seem to just let it slide, does he? It says, the officers reported this to the magistrates, and when they heard that Paul and Silas were Roman citizens, they were alarmed. They came to appease them and escorted them from the prison, requesting them to leave the city. So Paul and Silas were Roman citizens. As Roman citizens, they had civil rights that were violated by the magistrates. This is where Jam and I work. This is where our family serves. This is one of the communities served by Tender, our Christian nonprofit. You'll see in this picture, if you have a good eye, you'll see that actually a lot of these homes are on water. There's some water lilies and different plants, but you see all the boats. Most of the homes here are built on bamboo stilts over the bay. And in the Philippines, speaking of civil rights, I've seen firsthand how people living in marginalized communities like this are denied many of the civil rights and even basic rights that I've taken for granted. I've known people personally imprisoned with no lawyer and no due process. I've known children here who couldn't go to public school because they couldn't afford uniforms. They couldn't afford school supplies, public transportation. There's no free school bus. I've served communities like this where the majority of homes lack access to clean water or electricity. And through our Christian charity, Tender, we're fighting for those rights. We're fighting for those rights for those children and families. Through our child sponsorship program, God is using donors, many of you in this room, actually, in this sanctuary, to send children to school, being the difference between them being on the street at home or in school during the day. And our students are able to overcome generational poverty because of the response of God's people to incredibly unjust and unfair hardships. I want to tell you the story of one girl that grew up in our programs at Tender. Her name is Tin. And Tin is always the Filipino nickname for anyone named Christina or Christine. So if you're Christina or Christine and you come to visit the Philippines, people might call you Tin or Tintin. It's just like how sometimes Robert, it goes by Bob, right? Maybe not, we don't always see it, but Tintin is Christina. And so Tin is a girl who grew up in the most extreme poverty in Manila, Philippines. She started attending Tender's nutrition program. You see there, that's me doing a short-term trip in between semesters in university. And this is Tin right there. Here she is, coming just for the food. So we would go to their community and set up on the street in front of their shanties a few times a week, and we'd share about Christ, and we'd feed them a healthy meal. This is before we introduce our other programs. Tin started attending our nutrition program at the age of 4, and here she was living with her older sister, Jeliza, and her mother, Jonah Lynn, single mother. And as you can see, this is their entire home. It's mostly plywood, a tarp for a roof, very, very simple. And by God's grace, we were able to find a donor here in Ontario to sponsor her for just $1.25 a day. That's how much child sponsorship costs. Donors get a tax receipt. But a dollar, someone said $1.25 a day, what's that? $37.50 a month. I can afford that for Tin to be able to go to school. So she started going to school because of that donor. And every year she would get school supplies daily. We provided her fare, jeepney fare, to ride the jeepney to school. And she's so grateful to be able to go to school. Tin worked exceptionally hard in school to make her donor proud. She achieved high grades throughout her schooling. Tin also exhibited a strong faith, determination, and leadership qualities from a young age. So here she is. At the age of 10, she became our youngest volunteer. Now, if you're familiar with Woomba Camp, right, the kids' camp here, we did a fully-fledged Woomba Camp in Manila. In 2018, we had a team from WVCOM. This team partnered with my team at Tender, and we ran a Woomba Camp. A day camp is amazing, but we made it an overnight camp for several days. And Tin was not only a camper, but she wanted to volunteer. So she would assist with the activities. She was like a junior counselor. And then she also started attending our church and got baptized. These are two of my pastors at our church. She was baptized at quite a young age, and she started volunteering regularly at our preschool at Tender and helping tutor younger kids in the after-school program. Now, just because Tin found Tender or God brought Tender into Tin's life doesn't mean that her life instantly got better and that all of her problems were solved. Hardships continued to shape Tin's faith and her dependence on God. And in 2017, actually right before that Woomba camp, before that trip, Tin's home, the one you saw earlier, was demolished. The whole entire community was demolished for the development of a commercial property. So they're squatting. They don't own the land. They're not renting. So at any time, our communities can be demolished, and they have to start from zero, pick up and move. So we helped Tin and her family move to the community that you saw at the first picture. So In 2017, her family moved to this community built on bamboo stilts. They actually got the home right at the very end. So they had that beautiful lakefront view, but quite a simple community, right? And one day, three of Tin's uncles were moving some plywood from the former community to the new community. They were bringing some of the materials from their old homes to the new community. If you can picture Tin's three uncles carrying wood through narrow slum alleyways, when a group of men approached them, men they didn't know, strangers, this group of men approached them offering to help. And they said, oh, we'll help you carry that wood. Tin's uncles turned down the offer. There were three of them. They didn't really need help. But the strangers were persistent and they urged to help carry the plywood. So the strangers took some of the wood, but as they were walking down the alley following Tin's uncles, the strangers took a turn down another alley and started taking off the wood to steal it. Now Tin's uncle shouted, hey, that's the wrong way. Only they don't speak English. They would have shouted, hoy, san kayo papunta in Tagalog. They proceeded to chase after this gang of strangers. That's when the gang dropped the wood and revealed that they had knives and ice picks under their clothing. So ice picks are a common weapon of choice in the Philippines because, as the name suggests, they're for breaking up ice so you can buy it anywhere. They're steel picks with a very sharp, pointy end, breaking up ice, and they're also easy to hide, very affordable. So this gang pulled out knives and ice picks, and a struggle ensued. Multiple people were stabbed, multiple people were seriously injured, and none of the attackers were charged with anything. They got away, even though we actually found out who they are. We know who they are in that community. But to this day, none of these attackers have been charged. Now, incidents in overpopulated, poor communities in Manila are simply not a priority for the police and the courts in Manila. It's already overpopulated. The courts are overwhelmed and so backed up. And what really broke my heart was when Tin's single mother said these exact words, John, poor people do not have civil rights. That's what she told me when I asked for an explanation. Why? Why won't the police do anything? We know who these people are. But like Paul and Silas' story, the justice system was biased and broken. Imagine the feeling of Tin and her younger cousins when Tin's uncles came home with life-threatening wounds, one with a punctured lung who could barely breathe, all because of a few sheets of plywood, less than $100 worth of wood. Witnessing this atrocity and the lack of action by the justice system sparked a passion within Tin to pursue criminal law and to fight for the rights of Filipinos in poverty. So Tin continued to study in high school, and she graduated high school at the top of her class. She was extra motivated, and her graduating from high school was only made possible, again, because someone here said, $1.25 a day? I can cover that. That's how she was able to complete high school. And then Tin was offered a full scholarship into one of the most prestigious universities in the Philippines called De La Salle University. You can look it up. It's a very, very prestigious university because of her high grades. And Tin is now in her first year taking up a course in pre-law as she aspires to be a lawyer. Amen to that, right? Can we agree? Yeah, you can clap. We can clap to God for doing that, for orchestrating that. So can we agree that God can use hardships to ignite purpose and mission? God used the imprisonment of Paul and Silas for a jailer and his family, his whole family, to come to know God. God is using hardships in Tin's life to give her purpose and drive to make a difference for the marginalized in Manila. If that incident never happened to her uncle, something I never wished to have ever happened to anyone, Tin wouldn't have gained this mission to help the marginalized, stand up for the marginalized, and become a lawyer. Now, I don't know about you, but if I were in Tin's position, I'm a teenager, and my uncles come home, and there's no justice after what happened, I probably would have thrown up my hands and said, the justice system is rigged, right? The justice system is rigged in the Philippines. There's no justice. The voice have no poor. Not the poor have no voice. There's no voice for the poor. Sorry, I'm losing my English. My English is getting worse. I'm the only English speaker on my team. All of my, the entire team at Tender is Filipino, so we just speak Tagalog all day. If I were in Tin's position, I'd say there's no justice. But Tin had the courage not just to react. I'm sure she reacted, I know, because I saw her tears. She reacted with anger, with sadness, but then she responded. She said, instead of saying, there's no hope, she said, Lord, use me. Allow me to be a champion for the justice of the poor in your mighty name. So what's the application for us? What's the application for you? The application from Acts chapter 16 and from Tin's story. Remember I talked about reacting and responding. Let's try not to just react. Let's respond with purpose when hardships happen. So that's the first takeaway. When hardship hits, our first instinct is to react emotionally. Paul and Silas had every reason to react with anger, bitterness, or despair. But instead of reacting, they responded. What did Paul and Silas do? They prayed, they worshiped, they stayed faithful, and they protected others. So when hardship comes, try and pause before reacting. Instead of feeling powerless, like there's nothing you can do but just get emotional, which is natural. That's the instinct. Try asking, Lord, what are you doing here? Maybe there's a way you're going to use this hardship, or you're in the midst of this hardship. You're doing something. Maybe you can bring me into that. Choose faith before fear. I know it's hard. But remember, your response in hardship is going to determine whether that hardship becomes a bitter wound for the rest of your life or a calling, a purpose. Number two, your worship in pain is a witness. Remember in Acts chapter 16, when Paul and Silas were worshiping God, other prisoners were listening. Paul and Silas didn't know personally who was watching. They didn't know a jailer was on the brink of salvation, but their midnight worship became someone else's miracle. Your faithfulness in hardship is evangelistic. Your endurance can speak louder than your advice. When someone goes through a tough time and you say, you're going to be all right, I'll be praying for you, that can help sometimes. But if someone sees you go through a tough time, the way you worship, thank God, and depend on Him, that's powerful. That's going to rub off on people. Someone is watching how you handle trials. There's always someone watching. As a parent with young children, they are always watching how I handle things. If I curse or how I react in anger or sadness, that's a model for them. You may never know who's being drawn to Christ because of how you worship in your midnight hour. Number three, it is Christ-like to worship and Christ-like to confront injustice. So Paul didn't just sing hymns, but singing hymns is wonderful. Praying is essential. It's the first thing he did, right? Paul didn't just sing hymns. He also confronted the magistrates. Faith is not passive. Worship does not mean silence in the face of injustice. Paul praised God in prison and then demanded accountability from the abusers. So as Christians, we can pray and protest. We can worship and still work for justice. We can forgive and still demand due process. I know it's a line we have to walk as Christians because we're called to forgive and to have grace, but we're also called to protect those who are being abused, those who are being discriminated against. We don't just let that slide, right? It's a line we have to walk. Like the work of Tender and like Tin's dream of becoming a lawyer, I believe strongly we are all called to use our voices and rights to protect those who have none. Lastly, the fourth takeaway, God uses hardship to ignite calling. Paul and Silas brought a jailer and his family to salvation because of a prison sentence, because they were wrongfully imprisoned. That set this incredible salvation for the jailer and his family in motion. Tin found her calling because of injustice. So hardship can refine your faith, it can reveal your purpose, or it can clarify your mission. Maybe you already know what God's put on your heart to do. Maybe you already have a mission. And sometimes we need a little hardship to wake us up, to remind us, oh, right, depression is still real. Suicide is still happening every day. There are still kids in poverty who aren't eating three meals a day, who can't go to school. Sometimes a hardship is almost necessary to wake us up and remind you of your purpose, your mission, your God-given mission, if you don't know it yet. Now, I'm not going to put these questions up because I just want you to listen. What pain in your life angers you in a holy way? What injustice makes you want to flip tables like Jesus? Was that a reaction or a response when Jesus flipped tables? I don't know. I'm not going to answer that for you. But Jesus was human, right? He was God, but he was also human. Reacting isn't a sin. Emotions are not a sin. Maybe there isn't something that angers you that you want to flip tables. What is it then that breaks your heart in this world, in your community? What struggle has shaped you? And maybe it's there in that struggle or that issue that God is igniting your calling if you haven't already discovered it. Now, what a blessing it is for my wife and I to be able to commit our lives to serving children in extreme poverty. And at the table, out these doors, we've set up a table with brochures. There's a brochure about Tender, and there's a newsletter about the Coffee family, about our family. Please, please, before you go, and even before you go to the lunch, actually, we'll set up a table in the chapel with those things too. Please, please take a brochure. We have so many of them. If you want to learn more about our work at Tender, our Christian nonprofit, grab those brochures. And I also want you to read about sponsoring a child. Pray about it. I've said it before. It's only $1.25 a day. There's official tax receipts or $37.50 a month. You can be the difference between a child being in school or not. Just like what someone here did for Tin, you can do to another child. And it blesses my heart. I have this incredibly privileged position of being the channel of the blessings and witnessing the life change that happens through Tender as we disciple and mentor them and see them complete their education and go on to get jobs. Now, on the table there in the foyer and on the table in the chapel, you'll see, aside from the brochures, there's pictures of children. These are children at Tender in our communities, like the one you saw, that don't have a sponsor yet. There's actually more than 50 children on a waiting list. And these children are either not in school or they're in school, but they're at a high risk of drop out of elementary school because, again, they can't afford public transportation. There's no free bus. They can't afford uniforms, can't afford school supplies. And on those pictures of each child, it says their name, their aspiration, what they want to be when they grow up, whether it's a doctor or a policeman. And it also says some of their interests. So I urge you to consider taking one of those pictures, one or two. Just by taking a picture of a sponsor child doesn't mean you're going to sponsor that child, okay? We have extras of all of those children out there. But take one, pray for one of those children, and then there is information on the back on how you can sponsor that child. And when you follow the instructions on the back, we'll send you the full profile with all the details about that child. And you'll receive updates on them regularly, how they're doing in school. So please, please pray for that. And then lastly, this is something we're speaking at other churches, but I don't usually mention this at all the other churches. Jam and I are full-time missionaries. When Jam's not at home looking after she's a saint watching our children at home. And when our kids are all in school again, she'll be back. She's a teacher in our preschool program. She has a degree in education. And Jam and I have no salary aside from our personal support that we raise. So we also raise our own support. That is our bread and butter. That's our only income. So we are praying for a handful more of supporters. There's a shortfall of about $300 or $400 monthly. Some people want to sponsor children, and that's beautiful. And that's what I would love to see, more children sponsored. But some people love to sponsor missionaries. And when you sponsor Jam and I in any amount monthly, you know that we are dedicated. We're there for the long haul. The Philippines is home. As I've said, it's been home for me for 16 years. But we are there to the end. We want to see these children complete their education and go on to get jobs. God willing, I'll be there for the rest of my life, and we'd love to continue that work long-term. So investing in us, you know that you're investing in long-term community development, community transformation.